Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. And you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, co-host, and new guy over at the Boston Globe, Stephen Gordon.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I'm super fantastic. How are you, Stephen?
I'm doing great. Doing real good.
Well, you've had a pretty good week. Let's talk about this. I went and spilled the beans, but I think everybody who's in our circle already knows about this. But for all the, you know, hordes who have joined now listening to the program, what's been going on?
Well, I got something published over at the Boston Globe, and it was an article entitled "In the Future, Everything Will Be a Coffee Shop," and that was fun. The whole process was fun. Kind of give you a rundown. I published a blog post at The Speculist with the same title. Oh, what was that? I think that was before Christmas, wasn't it? It was.
It's been probably 2 months ago. Yeah.
Yeah, and then Glenn Reynolds he linked to it, and that got the attention of Amanda Katz, who works at the Boston Globe, and then she contacted me and said, can we, is this something we can use? Can you want to work with us to get this suitable for the Boston Globe? I said, absolutely, this will be fun. And so we, she basically, lifted it right off the page, did a selective rewrite, sent it to me, and we went back and forth probably four or five times getting getting it to where she was happy with it and I was happy with it, and then signed off on it, and it published in Sunday's paper in the Boston Globe. So it was fun. It was an interesting experience. I've not had that particular experience before, so that was fun. I guess I shouldn't say exactly that. I had something published a few years back about a bird flu in the local paper, Shreveport Times. But
I remember that. Sure.
Yeah. But this was a little more involved. We went through a lot more drafts to get it right. So, it was a fun give and take.
Well, I think it's extremely cool. I'm very proud of you, I have to say. Although I think, and take this the right way, but this is much more a reflection on the Boston Globe than it is us, because we were always awesome. I feel that the mainstream media is now catching up. Right, they're seeing our stuff and they're going, oh yeah, we actually do want to publish that kind of stuff.
I think it's
really encouraging.
I can tell you got your tongue in your cheek a little bit, but I'm going to tell you, and to some extent, the things that we were talking about, we've been writing about since, 2004, and were way out and wacky then, are pretty much becoming conventional wisdom now, so.
My tongue's not that much in my cheek. I think that's a big part of it, is the things that we've been writing about have become increasingly mainstream over the past few years, to the point that we're now looked to, at least in this instance, and I bet it happens again, as a source of content for a major mainstream media provider. I think it's a great sign, very encouraging for the Boston Globe, and I hope others follow suit and look to The Speculist and Fast Forward Radio for additional story ideas. So, we were talking right before the show started about whether we had enough to say on this topic to sustain another show, because we just did this. I think we did this right around the time you wrote that first piece, just a few weeks ago, and then we've had several blog posts following up since then. And I think there's still plenty to be said on this subject.
Yeah, there is. We ought to just launch into it. Yesterday, or actually it was the day before yesterday, in the Atlantic, Megan McArdle sort of took off on the post and said, well, here's, you know, I don't know that I necessarily buy that this is what will happen in education, but here are some things that I think would happen if education was coffee shopped, if people started, you know, getting their college education through, online sources rather than their local campus. And so she went into the implications of the idea, and then I responded by saying, well, I agree with some of your thoughts on the implications and some I didn't agree with, and I think that for once, Phil, you and I actually disagree on a point, and I think that that's interesting because we are so often in agreement on everything that we ought to just, you know, we ought to just hash it out right here on that one little piece that we disagree on.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's okay, Stephen. You can't be right all the time. So, you know, once
exactly.
in a while, you know, it's not, you know, people aren't expecting you to be perfect, okay? I mean, it's not like that. Well, actually, I did leave a comment on the blog. I thought it was great that Megan McArdle put this piece out, and I thought your responses were really good. There is one piece that I take issue with, and it's point number two, the idea that online education will kill the liberal arts degree. I understand the reasoning behind that. And the reasoning is that where we are in the economy right now is we've got a glut of people who have majored in liberal arts and people who've majored in fun things, and we've got a real shortage of people who've majored in STEM. So, you know, you make the comment that if liberal arts degrees kind of get pushed to one side, that's a good outcome because the future needs more STEM students. That part I'm not 100% convinced about, at least not as stated. And the reason is, there's a couple of reasons. One is I think that we're probably very close to the point where, and we can get into this the subject of robots stealing our jobs, where some of the low-hanging fruit of jobs to be stolen is actually going to be STEM careers. The stuff that you learn in a STEM major, unless you're becoming a theoretical physicist or something like that, you know, unless you're becoming somebody who generates theory, if you're any kind of practitioner in the sciences, or if you're any kind of engineer, if you're any kind of, you know, instructor, professor who teaches any of these classes, there's an excellent chance that a machine can start doing your job, that you can actually get outsourced by a machine more easily than, at this point, someone who has a degree in the liberal arts or who's gone into one of those fields. Now, that's not to say that I think that technical acumen isn't important. I think that probably what we're increasingly going to need is less of a distinction between those two things. We're probably going to want to get away from the idea that someone is either creative or technical. I think I've talked a little bit about Daniel Pink's book, A Whole New Mind, where he talks about the importance in the future that we're going to have equal emphasis on both the left brain and the right brain. I think we're going to see a lot more careers that work that way, and probably education is going to have to move in that direction too. You know, you've got a lot of people these days who are game designers and people who do very creative, very artistic jobs. What's their degree in? I'm not even sure. I'm guessing that some of them start out as techies and find that they have a creative bent. Others start out as art majors and find that they're able to handle the technology. But one way or another, I think that probably the two things start to converge in interesting ways, and we'll see an increase in what back in our day, Stephen, was referred to as double majors. I'm not sure that it'll even be thought of in that way anymore. It'll just be thought of, oh, you know, this. You need to have some engineering and you need to have some design, or you know, you need to know some math and you need to know how to write. That both of those things are going to be viewed as increasingly important because there's just a greater and greater need for content. And that's one thing that so far I think the computers can't generate. So I'm predicting, I don't make a lot of predictions, but I'm predicting that actually the liberal arts and the humanities are going to probably have a bit of a resurgence here in the next few years, probably be a little less scorned than they currently are.
Well, and so, you know, the kind of education you're talking about would be ideal for, you know, Pixar or Apple computers or
exactly,
you know, things like that, and where you know it's ideal to have a bent for both the technical and also you know the arts at the same time. I can see your point there. I can see your point. I guess what am I trying to say? I think that it's at the present time we have really got a glut, and it would take a while to get that turned around, and so you know perhaps we're just maybe our time the time frames that we're looking at might be just slightly different there, but yeah.
Well, to add a wrinkle, One of the things Sally points out here, perhaps some resurgence during the transition period. Oh, excuse me, I'm reading the wrong comment. She said people will do that stuff, but it's likely fewer and fewer will get paid, as in the ease of copying music and writing and art. That's true. It's harder to make a living. Actually, I'm not sure that's true. I think I started that sentence wrong. There's a perception that it's harder to make a living doing these things today than it was in the past. I actually think there's probably more people making a living doing these things than there has been in the past, but it's done in such an ad hoc way, such a ground up way that we don't recognize it. I think back in the day when people were sending content to a few publications and to a few major publishing houses or recording for a few big labels, there was a perception that there's that industry, there's the people who participate in it, they're all making money. And now that's become very diffuse, very dispersed, and you know, you've got people grinding out pot boilers for Kindle only, you know, who put out a new novel every 2 or 3 months and actually making a pretty good living writing that kind of stuff. But I wasn't actually thinking so much.
And they're selling these books often for like 99 cents or maybe $2 or something. The idea is this: I want it to reach as wide of an audience as possible, and for it to be an impulse buy, you know, where it's bought very cheaply by the user, and that works really well, particularly since once you've written the book, every additional copy of the book costs you nothing. So it's a very doable business model. Yeah, think of it this way: it's a little bit like book as an app, because you buy apps for your iPhone for $1, $2,
right?
And people manage to make money that way. Well, you know, this is the idea that I'm going to write a book and sell it for about the same price, and it works out too, you know. So, you know, and you're probably doing better, in some ways than you would do if you were publishing these things in a traditional way.
Well, if you sell a book for $2, $1.99 on Kindle, what are you seeing of that? $1.50, something like that?
Yeah. I wish I had that page in front of me. I've actually looked into it. I've considered, you know, publishing something that way.
And the truth is, if you sell a novel to a major publishing house and they put it out hardback and sell it for $35 in Barnes & Noble, for each copy you probably get about $1.50, right? I mean, the models are probably not even that much difference in terms of how much you're getting per unit, but it's so much easier to get multiple units out because the supply chain is so much easier to manage.
Right, right. Well, that's, again, getting back to the coffee shop idea, that's what we're looking at, is a future where authors are putting stuff out directly to the public, or, you know, with just the Kindle middleman, perhaps. And, you know, then they show up, in the coffee shop with a few paper copies, maybe printed out within the coffee shop by the espresso bookmaking machine or something like that, and they're signing copies that way. You could see something like that handled very ad hoc. You know, you just put up on your Facebook page or your, you know, for your followers, your Twitter followers or whatever, to I'll be in such place signing books, And you know, they show up or they don't, and you know, and you're just signing copies for people to happen to show up there on their own. But it's a different model from in the days when these things were managed by large corporations, and you know, wacky books didn't get published. You know, you didn't,
right.
If you have some wacky idea now, it can get published. Now it may not get a broad audience. You're not guaranteed that, but you know, it's out there. And it might catch on, it might not. So, it's an interesting day for books, especially.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's the coffee shopification of the publishing process. I mean, these trends are really closely related when you think about it. I talked about in the post that I did referencing your piece in the Boston Globe, this convergence that may or may not occur, because in your piece you talk about multiple different entities that become coffee shops, right? An office becomes a coffee shop, a retail store becomes a coffee shop, a university becomes one, and you know, I start pondering that, I start thinking about that, and I'm like, okay, well, if I've been running an office park all these years and I turn it into, you know, I know I'm not going to have a regular tenant, so I'm going to set it up as a business. It's a place where people can come and they can use space. Am I aiming that open space? Because presumably in the model you talked about, there's a certain open space where people are sitting around drinking coffee, sharing ideas, they're meeting up and all that kind of thing. And then you've got some premium space like meeting rooms and cubicles and things like that that you're charging for. Am I going to target a particular industry? Am I going to target the kinds of business people that used to come in here? Or do I open it up wide and I say, hey, you know, other people are doing this for universities. Well, we never were a university, but it doesn't matter, right? We've got internet connections here. We can get people to come here and be tutors. We can be as much a center for that as someone else can. So the question is, do we have specialized coffee shops, or do we have general purpose coffee shops, or do we have, you know, cross functional, or do they change roles over time? What's your thinking on that? Do they all become McDonald's of people meeting up in the end, or do they become highly specialized hubs of particular kinds of people?
Yes, is my answer to that.
Okay,
there's going to be some coffee shops that obviously are near, you know, particular things. Perhaps a university that's shrinking down because of the coffee shopification of education, and perhaps that coffee shop will cater to those people, and then, you know, other coffee shops will do other things. But I think, you know, what I'm envisioning here is a future where things move so quickly that, you know, today, Phil, you show up at your favorite coffee shop working on a project, you know, some marketing project. You know, and when that project is done, and the group that you're working with disbands, and some of the group you'll be working with will be present in your coffee shop virtually, and others will be there with you physically. When that particular project disbands, you might show up at that same coffee shop the very next day to be a tutor for some college kid that's trying to learn marketing. You know, you change overnight. So your coffee shop changes overnight. You know, I mean.
So that's great. It's not necessarily the place. It's the different roles that the individuals there might be playing.
Exactly.
And people would be meeting there socially as well. I mean, you don't want to discount that. That's going to be part of it too.
So it's the same coffee shop is a bookstore. It's an office. It's your university. It's also a factory because you got a premium commercial level 3D printer in the back that you can't afford to have in your house. Now your house has a 3D printer too, but the quality of items that you can get from that, it'll be a little less than what you could get from a commercial grade machine. And so for certain things you're going to have to go there. And so that's what the coffee shop serves as at that point. So, you know, if it's even called a coffee shop, if people think of it as a coffee shop, you know, yeah, you get coffee there, but there's so much more going on. I don't, you know, what do you call a place like that? Maybe we don't know yet. Maybe it'll have a name at some point, but that's,
I'll tell you one thing, Stephen. If in the future these places, these multi-purpose facilities where people meet up, are called coffee shops, we're going to know who named them that, okay? We are going to know who started that. That's going to be pretty cool because I'll be going, hey, my buddy said that the first, okay? I don't know if you know that, but Stephen Gordon is the first person ever called
yeah,
the coffee shop.
Yeah, you know, time to run down to the Gordon coffee. No.
And, you know, it'd be bad enough me doing that, Stephen. I can just see you showing up at a place, huh?
Oh, it's bad.
Let me mentor you young people here. Let me tell you some very interesting history about how the world used to work. Now, let's talk a little bit more about what happens with education, because I feel like we jumped off that sooner than we wanted to. We got hung up on the one point. Meghan McArdle takes the position that she's not a big booster like some of us, and she's not sure she buys into it. But by the time you read through all of her points, how far off is she really from the coffee shop idea? She's got about 95% of tenure track professors losing their jobs. You know, the whole educational experience sounds pretty transformed by the time by the time you get through that whole list. Do you think
you're
as far apart as she thinks?
Here's the thing. She's saying, I don't know that I necessarily buy that it's going to happen. But if it were to happen, here are the implications of the idea. So she's not, you know, I don't think she's saying, I don't buy that it's going to happen, but here's what I see is going to happen. She's saying, you know, if then, there's an if then statement involved here, okay? So, and obviously she finds the idea interesting, or she wouldn't have gone this deep into it. But, I don't know that she necessarily buys this will go down this way because, you know, her exact quote is, let's see if I can get it real quick. I've watched a lot of disruptive innovations get killed or co-opted by incumbents or undermined by features of the market that weren't immediately obvious to the outside observer. And then she goes, and that's true. Some things just
that's a good
look
point,
like,
yeah.
It looks like it's, you know, something's really going to take off, and then it's just things are kind of normal after that, you know. So, great. There is all that, but what are we talking about? We're talking about something that's. I'll put it this way: I think that this particular future has a lot of redundancy built in. It may not happen this way. It may not happen that way. There might happen this third way we're not even thinking about. But I think at some point, this is a future that looks pretty strong. There's some strong reasons we're going in this direction. There's a lot pushing in this direction,
and we might see it as a transitional stage too. But it seems to me that I'm dealing with just a little bit of a cough here, so I'm trying not to fall apart here on the show. Can you talk just for 1 second, Stephen? I'm going to mute myself just for a minute.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. Get something to drink. Well, you know, talking about McArdle's points here, she talks about education will end up being dominated by a few huge incumbents, and you know, that it seems to me if we're going online with an online education, you end up with some big guys that are really, you know, that's where everybody goes. You know, you might be X, it might be Apple Computer. You know, with their iTunes University they have already that they're cranking things out through. It might be, you know, Salman Khan with his Khan Academy that's really takes over everything. But I don't think that we have 500 universities anymore. We have, you know, we probably have a dozen. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. But one thing it means is that, you know, you can't be a diploma mill if you're one of 12.
Right, right.
You've got, you know, if you're one of 12, you've got to be awesome, or everybody will know. You can't just, you know, I can't show up with a credential from, you know, a one of 12 and have people not know what that particular credential means.
That's right. They're going to be the elite. They're going to be the creme de la creme.
Exactly.
Institutions. And that's the only way in this model that they would survive. But let's push it even farther. There's a great exchange here in the chat room between Sally and Jab, and they're talking about Sally points out that Barnes & Noble has had cafes for years, and then Jab says, but aren't they killing them off now? So here's the question. How long does the coffee shop model stay ahead of the fact that maybe even the whole idea of work is kind of up in the air, right? Because you're talking about, well, we won't have offices like we used to, but we'll have this kind of office, and you won't get a degree like you used to get a degree. You're gonna get this kind of a degree. But if the robots are stealing our jobs, to use the popular phrase that's bouncing around this week, are people gonna even need a place to get together and have meetings? I mean, is there a future for the coffee shop in a post-employment world? Put it that way. And does it help, in your view, does it help push us in that direction or help organize getting us there?
Until we really are robots ourselves, the answer is yes, because we always are going to want to meet with other people. And I can't imagine not enjoying a cup of coffee or the beverage of your choice. So
that's right.
Get together
and have a latte and talk about the fact that the robots took our
job.
It sucks,
anymore.
Right? Here we sit.
Yeah.
Or it's great. Here we sit, right? However you want to look at it.
Yeah, I used to be a barista in this coffee shop until R2-D2 over here stole my job. You're always going to want to have a place to go and even in a post-employment world. But so does the coffee shop stay with us even there, even that far into the future? I would guess so. There's we will tend to get together.
See, I think so too. I think that what happens is whatever happens with the economy and whatever happens to the idea of employment, and we can get into that a little bit in the second half if you want to, but whatever takes place there, there will be a venue. There will be a place where people get together and do what they originally did at these salons that you talked about in the piece that you wrote. People get together and exchange ideas, even if it's not in the context of getting a formal degree, even if it's not in the context of a particular deal coming down. I mean, most of what goes on in coffee shops today is just that. They get together and talk. I think that there will be a perceived greater and greater need for that. We have a lot of venues for that now. We have social networks for that. We have, the web provides any number of ways of doing that. But I think it's going to continue to be important for people to interact in real life and in real time, even if you get past the whole idea of formal education, even if somehow you get past the whole idea of employment as we understand it today, a place where people can meet and where ideas are being exchanged, to use Matt Ridley's phrase, where ideas can get together and have sex, is still going to be hugely important.
Yep.
And probably still fueled by coffee as it was in the beginning.
And that whole idea, because I find that interesting. Was it Steven Johnson who kind of brought that up in a particular speech? I think it was. His idea that the Age of Enlightenment was born in these coffee shops because, quite frankly, these people drank less ale and started drinking more coffee, and all of a sudden they had ideas to share.
So they're feeling a little perkier. And it's like, oh, wait, I got another idea, right? Yeah, that dynamic, sure.
Yeah, they started, and pretty soon they started, one shipping merchant would thought, maybe I should bet against my particular ship making it, because if it doesn't make, if it makes it, great, I make a profit, but if it doesn't make it, then that helps me recover from the fact that I lost a ship.
The old hedge,
So the insurance industry was coffee shops. So that was the beginning of a lot of interesting stuff. And so maybe we end up back in coffee shops much like that. So
I think so. I think that would be a happy place to end up. But let's talk a little bit about the where employment is going. This is actually the topic that I'm covering over on Transparency Revolution podcast this evening as well. I was telling you before the show started that I was interviewing. Excuse me, I'm having just a little bit of trouble with this cough. Interviewing Federico Pistono, who wrote this piece over on IEEE, Robots Will Steal Your Job, But That's Okay, How to Survive the Economic Collapse and Be Happy. And you had been tweeting about that. I've been doing blog posts and a podcast about this. So,
same thing. And I had this idea, Phil, that, you know, maybe what we should do is have this guy on the show, and come to find out, doggone it, you got the guy for your other podcast.
Yeah, I took him over to the other show. But I did tell him, he's an interesting guy. He's going to be on he's going for graduate studies at Singularity University in June. And I asked him if he would come on Fast Forward Radio after that and tell us about the whole thing. So he's agreed to do that. So we will be talking to him on this program as well in a few months.
So his book, this is an interesting thing. He has got a book coming out, and the title of the book is Robots Will Steal Your Job, But That's Okay, How to Survive the Coming Economic Collapse. Well, that book is coming out this year. And I thought it was interesting. I clicked over to the website for that particular book, and it was basically saying, well, the book's coming out in the summer, and, you know, you can get a paper copy if you do this or that. Come to find out, it was crowdsourced. He was, you know, basically has said, here's the idea I've got for a book, and he put it out on the net, and he raised money. So he basically got his book advance through crowdsourcing, and people, you know, if you pay, you know, $5, you'll get a PDF copy of the book. If you pay $10, I'll send you a signed paper copy of the book. $20 gets you a signed hardback, you know, and then, you know, on and on. And then I think something, it was like $50, you know, I'll have a Skype conversation with you for 30 minutes, that kind of thing. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing. And he had raised something like about $2,500 to $3,000, somewhere in that range, enough to really warrant putting the time and effort into really getting this thing going. And I'm hopeful that the book will be great. The first chapter or so that's available certainly was interesting. I read it.
Was that the piece that he put on IEEE, or has he actually published a chapter of the book?
It was a piece on the IEEE that I believe is like the first 10 pages of the book kind of thing. Fascinating. He covered some ground that, of course, has been covered before by Kurzweil and others. But he showed something that Kurzweil had not shown, and I thought it was very interesting. He says, you know, the exponential trend that we're all very familiar with of computation, you know, all the way to mechanical computers of the late 1800s till now, we're all familiar with the fact that that's an exponential trend. But he was, you know, but he said, here's the log plot of that exponential trend. And even the log plot had an upward curve to it. And so he was able to show that, you know, it's not just an exponential trend, but there's an exponential trend within the exponential trend. In other words, the doublings are getting faster. You know, at the first, you know, 1800s, you had doublings every 5 years. Now we're at a doubling every year. So it's a slow, gradual exponential within the exponential. But man, that's still powerful, isn't it? I mean,
it's accelerating faster. You faded on me there for a minute, Stephen, and I don't know if that was something on my line or something on your line. But just to recap what you were saying, because I caught the end of it there, and I think probably everyone else is hearing what I'm hearing, so I'm not sure. But the idea is that this hockey stick curve that you see, explaining an exponential trend, something like Moore's Law, right, which shows this rapid, sharp, knee of the curve going up trend. If you lay that out as an exponential curve, then you should see like a more or less straight line, right?
Exactly.
Normally, right? That's what you would normally see happen. And you look in Kurzweil's books, you'll see that. You'll see, oh, that looks like just a straight line. And you look and you go, oh, wait, it's exponential. So we're seeing, powers of 10, actually, with each point in the line. It's moving up. And now, so repeat that part about the one that is actually curving inside a logarithmic.
Okay, well, you know, the logarithm that shows, you know, the increase in computation is, it would normally be a straight line, but it's actually a slow curve upward, and the reason is the periods between the doublings is actually getting smaller and smaller. You know, back in the 1800s, it was, you know, 5 years, which is still pretty fast for a doubling, you would think. But it's pretty awesome. But now we're having doublings every year. So it's a real gradual curve, so gradual that perhaps even Kurzweil didn't take note of it. But this guy did and points it out in that article I just put the link to in the chat room. So, I found that interesting. That's powerful when you're when the exponential that all these predictions depend on has within itself another exponential.
Right. Well, it's that level of doubling when the infrastructure is accelerating at that kind of rate, that ultimately the economy itself catches up and you get into these scenarios that are almost unimaginable to me, anyway, I think to people living in our world, the kind of stuff Robin Hanson talks about where in the future when the size of the economy will double every 11 days, right? I mean, that's the kind of the kind of thing we're looking forward to. And you know, he's an economist, and he's perfectly serious when he says, nope, that's where we're headed. That's what's going to happen. Now, if you live in a world where the economy doubles every even 6 months, right, even every year, it seems as though you really don't have to worry about whether there's such a thing as a job anymore. That at some point we've rounded the corner and, you know, we've hit the world of abundance, the topic of Peter Diamandis' book that we'll probably be talking about either next week or the week after. And everything's going to be okay. There's still this interesting issue about how it all gets handed out, right? You know, it's like, well, that economy's, you know, doubling at that rate. Are there big corporations that are putting us all kind of on the dole for using their stuff? Are we all shareholders in those companies? Is the government writing checks to us? Are we all just, we've all got 3D printer, you know, the ultimate 3D printers in our backyards, and we're producing all of our own stuff? Is it some interesting combination of those? But it's, you know, yeah. It's this coffee shopification of the country, right, of the world that starts to occur at that point.
Yeah, I think it's all of those things. I mean, when you're talking about economies that are booming, so you know the entire economy is accelerating at that pace, then you don't have to have a big piece of that pie to be doing quite well. You could be, you know, and so what do you have to do to have a piece of that pie? Well, my thought is that you may not have anything that we would recognize today as you know, I mean, in an economy where the robots have stolen all your jobs, then your ability to add anything of value is, you know, kind of diminished at that point. But if you do manage to add anything of value, then your reward so is far beyond anything that the present economy will reward you. So, I mean, the least little contribution makes you wealthy beyond our current ability to imagine. But, you know, you also have a system where the government's, taxing and passing out checks. You've got to own stocks, you know, own the robot that stole your job. You know, if you can, get stock in that company. And produce as you're able to. And there's government largesse as well. I mean, people will survive when abundance is everywhere. It's hard to imagine being poor even if you're unemployed. I agree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like there's hard to have a model where it doesn't work out if you reach that point. I mean, if the economy were if our countries or say the world gross domestic product were 10,000 times the size it currently is, right? I mean, if that were to happen in 2 or 3 years or some outrageous thing like that, even if 80% of that went to government waste, right, we'd still be so far ahead. I mean, you know, you reach this point where you say, well, I don't know which model will win out. It probably won't matter. This is probably the one thing Marx got right about the state withering away. It's like, whatever mechanism you want to use, you know, you can call it a company, you can call it the government, you can call it an ad hoc committee. Suit yourself. Here's your money. But the stuff will be there, and and we'll be okay. I mean, I feel that if you can reach that point, if the world doesn't fall apart, getting there, then you're in fine shape. The worry, as Martin Ford talks about, and Pistono talks a little bit about Martin Ford as well, is that you know what if we collapse the economy on the way there? We need a transitional way of getting from here to there. We need a model that you know somehow incrementally, step by step, gets us from one stage to the next. And this is where I would bring up this series that have you been reading these essays by Walter Russell Mead over on the American Interest? Beyond the Blue, Beyond Blue, something like that. But he's been talking about the future of the economy, talking about some of these same issues, but he takes a somewhat different tack. And his view in the near term is that our economy is going to transition to one of people providing personal services to each other. And I actually quoted this over on Transparency Revolution in the same post where I was talking about Pistono's piece. Excuse me, just for a sec.
Okay.
Here's this quote from Mead. I shared the same quote over on the Transparency Revolution earlier today. He writes, "People don't run out of wants and needs, and when they have enough food, enough clothing, enough shelter, and enough warmth. In fact, liberated from the constraints of the struggle for survival, the human imagination discovers new wants and needs at a faster pace as the old ones are met and forgotten. This hunger for new, richer, and more interesting lives ensures that we can all keep making a living, and it ensures that we will also want to keep working so as to afford the cool new services and experiences being created around us. As long as humanity keeps wanting, humanity can make a living satisfying wants and creating new ones." And he describes what I would consider to be a transitional economy before true abundance arrives. But it's an economy where you've got like a lot of very well-paid chefs and massage therapists and, people who teachers of different kinds, gurus of different kinds, people who provide a lot of them one-on-one, but services to other people. And it's very interesting. He talks about the arguments for and the arguments against that. And he makes a comparison between the cutover from an agrarian economy to a manufacturing economy. And one of the things that I didn't realize is that a lot of the same arguments that people make about a personal service economy not being viable were made about people moving to a manufacturing economy. There was this fear that farms are the only things that really produce the real stuff, that food is kind of the ultimate thing, and that we'd be pushing people off into this kind of side business that would never work. Also, it was believed that factory jobs at the time paid very little and that they would never pay well. So, it's hard to imagine that was ever the attitude when you consider that in the middle part of the 20th century, up until even the later part of the 20th century, that was considered the mainstay of the economy and where people would go to get, like, a good, solid job.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he's right, but it seems to me that if that's one possible good model, then there are probably some other ones as well.
Right. I think that he's right up until the point at which robots are doing better massage therapy than we are. There comes a point at which even that particular model kind of breaks down a little bit. You mentioned something earlier. I think we should point out as well the idea of loyalty cards and things like that. You go to a particular grocery store, you pull out your loyalty card, you get a discount, right? I think that particular model might become more important in this kind of economy where, you've eaten at McDonald's every day for the past 5 days. We're going to award you with some minute amount of stock in the company, that kind of thing. You could end up seeing things like that so as to basically allow more ownership being pushed out to more people. I think that could potentially be a way to go. Particularly if let's say a central authority, a government, says, "Look, we need more people to be owners. let's give corporations an incentive, tax incentive to push ownership out to the population. They give that incentive, the corporations respond, and you end up with things like loyalty systems where everybody becomes minute owners, fractions of stocks perhaps, but that begins to accumulate over time. The more you're loyal to a particular business, perhaps. I don't know. Maybe something like that would be a part of the way that you earn a living in that particular economy.
Well, as crazy as that sounds to people, that's really just an extension. It's a very logical extrapolation from how those programs work now.
Yep.
When you think about something like an airline mileage rewards program, if you're a consumer, the more and better of a consumer you are of their particular service, the more free service they're going to give you. So obviously every time they give a free flight away, that's cutting into what they have to sell. I mean, they're subtracting a little bit from the bottom line in order to keep the loyalty of that customer, because it's perceived that the long-term investment, the long-term value to the company of having that person continue to be a loyal customer and keep booking all their flights to that airline, it's worth it. It's worth it to give them those flights. All you're doing is you're taking the next step and you're saying it's actually worth it to this company to give them a little bit of the company to keep them buying our stuff. It's like active participatory consumerism. It's a very consumer driven economy at that point. It almost feels like the dog walking the man to an extent. But it truly does just extrapolate right out of existing models.
Yeah, like you said, there's lots of ways this could happen. Lots of ways that it could happen, but if you're able to reach abundance without the world burning before you get there, then it works out somehow. Somehow we're going to be okay at that point. If there's billions of dollars here and billions of dollars there being produced all the time, even without our input, then it's hard to imagine us not doing okay. I guess the question then becomes, well, how do we occupy our time in ways that are meaningful? Well, perhaps we spend our time figuring that out. And, I think you could still have a pretty interesting life.
It's a good problem to have. Somebody in the chat room said earlier that, hey, sexy mortal billionaires with superpowers don't have to have jobs. And that's right. It becomes robot work at that point. So what do they do? That's their challenge. That's what they're going to have to figure out. Our job is to become them, and then their job is to figure out what they do with their time. I think. I mean, we have some ideas, but we don't have to solve that problem yet.
Yeah, they're at the top of Maslow's pyramid. We're a little further down.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, right.
Yeah.
How
do you best spend your billions and enjoy your centuries-long life to people who have that? Our challenge is to get to there, right? We've actually got a much clearer and more definable set of goals that we're working towards than they do. Now, actually, when you get there, when we're them, we'll look at it and we'll go, oh, no, look, obviously our path is clear, and what we have to get to next is very clear. But we can't see, that's not something we can see from here. At least we could speculate about it, but I don't think we can understand what will be the urgent next step for people who live in a world of abundance any more than I think, people living in a previous era could understand what we're talking about when we talk about getting to that era.
And they'll have problems. They will have what they consider to be just terrible problems that spend their time working on. We would of course look at their lives and go, what in the world are you worried about? And they're thinking, I don't have the money to go to Mars next year. I really was hoping to do that.
You know, so everybody else is going, and I'm not going. My life is a tragedy.
Everybody else is going, and all I can do is go to the freaking moon. And, you know, so they'll have problems. They'll figure out ways to feel like the world, terrible to them. But, it'll be a fantastic world, though.
In the chat room, Jeb says, Japanese retired ladies don't do knitting clubs. They get together in their homes and trade currencies. I love that. You know? they get together and they do currency trading. So that's that sort of fits. I think that we talked about it a little last week too, when we're already at a point where sending, becoming the third nation on the moon takes three guys working part time.
Yeah.
What individuals will be able to do with their time? And virtually unlimited resources that will be available to them, given that time and given those resources, it's pretty hard to imagine. But you can get some ideas looking at the world today. You can get some ideas of the kinds of creative things that people do now, and the kinds of things everybody imagines they would like to do. I think maybe one of the gaps we need to close in getting to this world is people need to start engaging with the future a little bit more imaginatively than they currently do. I don't think that people really grasp the opportunity that is before us. I don't think people have a really clear idea of how wide a spectrum of possibilities are about to open up, are open now even, but much less the ones that are about to open up. I'm hoping that there's going to be a change of understanding around this. I think that things like the Immanis book coming out is going to be tremendously helpful. Kurzweil has helped kind of lay a base for people to have an understanding of that, and I think that Kurzweil talks about the process, and he talks about the eventuality of what's going to happen. Now with abundance, we're starting to think about how this impacts individuals. We're starting to think about what this does to life, and life is going to be very different. I think people they can't start thinking about that soon enough.
Exactly. And I think, like we've kind of hinted at throughout the show, the trick is to being there. Once you're there, it's, many of the things that we concern ourselves with today, not just big problems at that point, but the getting there is going to be pretty tough. It's going to be a pretty rocky road, I would imagine, because it's going to involve, for one thing, a lot of unemployment. People will begin to lose jobs to robots, or just a lot of jobs just will be phased out. And so, how do you survive to get there? So I'm looking to that particular book coming out. The book is Abundance. I believe it comes out. Is it later this month, Bill?
It's coming out, I believe, on Tuesday, the 21st of February.
Okay, great. I'm looking forward to it.
Stephen and I have both pre-ordered copies. I've been looking on the site to see if I can find a contact there. If we can get one of the authors on the show, obviously that would be awesome. But even if not one of the authors, if we get somebody from that organization to come and talk on Fast Forward Radio, that would be tremendously enlightening, I think. And I think you make a really good point. And we keep coming back to this, but there's this very tricky transition. I hope it goes smoothly. I hope that the economy picks up and we find a very smooth path to abundance. But even if it's a hard and bitter path, what could be more worth getting there, right? We certainly don't want to dismantle the automation and the technological development and the economic development that's pushing us in that direction, right? We don't want to say, okay, well, we're losing all our jobs, so we got to kill all the robots, right, and go back to like sort of mid-20th century so everybody has a factory job. Not when that's sitting on the other side.
Yeah, and quite frankly, if we were to do that, if we were to all become Luddites, Phil, and just try to push in that direction, a lot of people would die. I mean, I say that quite seriously because lives depend on the way the world is set up now. And if you were to try to go backwards with it, for one thing. You couldn't get people back onto farms fast enough to produce the food we'd need if you tried to, like, for example, push automation out of agriculture. If you did that overnight, you know, we'd have to so return to subsistence farming, a lot of us, that I think there'd be food shortages in a lot of places in the world. So, yeah, the world depends on the way the world is now, so we can't go backwards. And going, you know, and the direction forward, it seems like there's a lot of momentum in the directions we're talking about. So, hang on, it's going to get, you know, it seems like we're in for a bit of a bumpy ride the next few years.
Well, we'll see. Like again, yeah. As I said, hopefully it's smooth. We should be looking for ways to make it smooth. I believe there are smooth paths. I hope we find one. I hope we stumble upon one, or someone says, "Wait, let's do it this way," and it works out. It's not encouraging that we have a media and a political class that have no idea that any of this is going on. Right? This is like the change that's taking place in the world, and they're not even looking at it. They're not even thinking about it. And when the jobs start to disappear, you can imagine the finger pointing and the blame and the we've got to do this insane thing, or we've got to do that insane thing, responses that might come. But, you know, circling it back to a point I made earlier, once again, very encouraging that the Boston Globe picked up a speculist article. Maybe the media is ready to start thinking about some of these things. And if they start thinking about some of these things, who knows, maybe even our political class will get on board and start entertaining some of these ideas as well.
Now you are talking crazy, Phil. So.
It's all this cold medicine I've been taking.
Yeah, kind of. You need to lay off that stuff, man. You're just talking out of your head at this point.
It's gotten completely to my head. Well, that's the hope. The hope is that either those things happen and they get on board, or we, you know, those of us who understand what's happening make them irrelevant and we push ahead without them and let them catch up.
Right.
Because
I think space is a good example. I think that governments are getting out of the business, at least our particular government is, and I think Russia as well, is getting out of the business of space. But does that mean that mankind gives up on space? Absolutely not. I think you got a couple of professors in about to put a probe on the moon. You got SpaceX, which is going to be the vehicle, I think, that will end up servicing the space station and may end up taking us back to the moon, what SpaceX is doing. You know, and you've got all kinds of, things like Virgin Galactic that takes we tourists up and gives us a little taste of space. So, you know, we end up doing things that, you know, the government used to do because we have the ability to do them.
When you think about it, we've already sort of eaten the media's lunch that way anyhow. I mean, that's what the whole blog revolution has been about. Now we're just kind of taking stuff out of the hands of the government as well. And if they want to catch up later and try to be relevant, let them. But meanwhile, we're gonna push on ahead.
Absolutely. Well, I guess we're at the end of the program, aren't we?
That takes us right up to our time. Stephen, what's our music this evening?
The music this evening is Thunder Without Rain by Alec Burke.
Okay, Alec Burke, Thunder Without Rain. Well, thanks for getting that put together. Thanks to everyone who was listening live this evening and our friends in the chat room. And for all of you listening via MP3, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be back again with an all-new show next week. We look forward to having you with us then. And until next time, live to see it.
Every now and then I get the urge to call her up and see what's going on. We once tried to make it through the night, but we stumbled over dawn. And I don't really miss her, but sometimes I still find my mind wandering. Even though the rain has stopped, maybe somewhere it's still thundering. Won't stop the sky. goodbye, our time was up. It was like the universe had sprung with